Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Politics But Were Afraid to Ask. Our presenter is John Marty. Let's listen in.
And the whole point of this one is to be open up to whatever people want to talk about politics, either a political issue or a political process or anything related to it. And it's interesting, yeah, I had somebody come talk to me a few minutes ago who different political persuasion than mine and expressed some concerns, and I said, fine, because sometimes people are more comfortable doing it one-on-one, but often people have questions or want to debate something or whatever, or make some points. And I often do with my constituents, town meeting types of things, which are, I see that is, they tend to be about specific issues we're working on at the Capitol. I've done this before at Holden, and sometimes people get into issues such as, what do you see the role of the legislature? I mean, a lot of people think politicians should be doing what the public wants. That means you should take, I mean, in effect, if you had polls, you'd be a pollster, and you'd do what your constituents want. I don't see my role that way. I'd be happy to explain how I see it, but I see the role of a politician should be, elected official should be. But happy to talk. I figure no issues off limits here, and no issue or policy or practice or how the process works, question or anything. So it's just basically a free-for-all, whatever you want, whichever way the direction goes. Does anybody have anything they want to start with?
I have a question then, if that's the case.
Sure.
We're mired down now in partisan politics, especially on the national level.
Right.
We have an election coming up and another one 2 years later. How do we get out of this? Historically, the leadership has risen up. It's taken us out of this sort of thing. I just don't see it happening right now, but then maybe it will happen. But how do we get out of this slogging through partisan politics,
right,
which slows everything?
I wish I had a perfect answer for that.
And John, would it be helpful to know who people are?
Yeah, maybe we should do that.
Where
people
you're from,
would at least say,
okay,
names where you're from, so I haven't done that in sessions, but this would be a good idea.
Okay, my name is Bill Planky. I'm from Tacoma, Washington.
Hey,
thank you.
Yeah, if everybody can start by doing that. I'm John Marty from Roseville, Minnesota. I do think one part of that is the person who's in the White House right now. I think George Bush said he was a uniter, not a divider. But I think the opposite is the reality. And I think right after his re-election, he says, I've now got some political capital and I'm going to spend it. I think that politicians who claim they have a mandate to do what they want are always should be suspect. I've won most of my races by 55, whatever percent. I ran for governor and got 38% of the vote. I got creamed in November. I don't know that I would say my opponent, when I know how little a lot of people knew about what either of us stood for, would not say my opponent has some massive mandate. So I think when politicians go that route, you're bound to be that way. And most presidents, I think, well, most politicians seem to want to try and, they don't want to offend people. And they do try to pull things together on the shelves, but there are a growing number on both sides who want to pull things apart. And I don't argue for a minute that people shouldn't have the beliefs they hold. Actually, my bigger beef on the issues is that a lot of people don't stand for anything. They just kind of are trying to do what they think is popular because they want to get power. I don't see any problem in the political system with widely divergent points of view. The two things that bother me are, one, the fact that we can't talk with each other, we can't be friends with each other, and number two, we don't listen to the other side because they're wrong, we're right. And when the public, I think the public often, many people get involved in politics because of one issue or two issues, and later on they get involved in more issues because they're involved in it, and they get to know candidates, and they work for a political party or for candidates, so they get involved in other issues, and most of the time, then that's good because it helps them see, the people they saw as the evil, the villains, because they're against them on the issue they cared about. They found, you know, that guy agrees with me certainly on these issues, though, and they're pretty thoughtful. So I think it helps. I mean, I used to think the legislature was a good moderating influence because I remember my first year there was this one guy who was kind of a jerk. He was always trying to ridicule people and real nasty, and he, on top of that, he didn't agree with me on any issue. So you think, what good is this guy? And he disagrees with me on all of everything, and he's got to be nasty on top of it. And then the next day, of course, he's the one who provides the deciding vote in favor of your amendment or something. And he's like, well, maybe they're not so bad after all. But really, I think a lot of people in public office have been less antagonistic towards each other than the public is. But public officials have been getting more antagonistic, partly because of nasty campaigns. You know, if the other folks on the other side, and it's often in Minnesota, it's the other party goes after you with independent expenditures attacking you. Very unfair in both sides, I would argue. And when somebody does that to you, they're trying to lie, cheat, and steal against you. Hard to be friends with them. Yeah. And so I think there's a growing, that's happening in Minnesota, every state where they're further apart from each other. And as politicians get that way, they don't help pull the country together. So I would say at the national level, change in the White House, whichever, I mean, I don't know who all is going to be running yet, but I would guess most candidates from either party would be better than this one in terms of uniting. But that's my speculation. I wish I could answer how we could make things peaceful all together.
Leadership, is it?
Leadership would help.
Leadership.
You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about how in Minnesota, this was a prize to me. I said, you know, I've been attacked on the thing for being a cause for being a lot of division and lack of civility at the Capitol. Why? Because I carried a bill successfully about 12, 13 years ago now that banned all gifts from lobbyists and interest groups to public officials. Why is that causing lack of civility? Well, because public officials, we don't go to all these receptions and parties anymore where we get to know each other socially. And whenever they, and it passed almost unanimously because they were scared to vote against it. They kind of trapped on voting for it. But it's, I joke and I'll say the exact words they call it. It's known as the goddamn Marty gift ban. 12 years later, among the public officials, not among the public, but I can go to city council meetings someplace and I'll hear that. And whenever one of my colleagues or a lobbyist or somebody says, yeah, I mean, John, don't you think we should loosen this up so we can have more civility around here? I say, I mean, look at what's happening to our political system. I think, yeah, that's right. I mean, the Arkansas legislature is so vicious because Minnesota banned lobbyists from giving gifts. I mean, it's happening around the country. And one of my colleagues who wasn't fond of the gift ban, but who is sick of people picking on me and on it, said, you know, why can't we just meet together on our own as a caucus or meet with the Republican caucus or whatever, go out to dinner, take each other out to dinner. We don't need a lobbyist to pay the bill in order to do it. So it was weird when I told this person, they're blaming that for incivility in politics, but it really is blamed there in Minnesota for it. So. But every state's got the same thing that I can see.
I almost wonder if there's not sort of a holistic way to look at what Bill... My name is Jack Devon. I'm from Tacoma also. I'm reminded of your comments yesterday about the media and how it can lend itself to sort of sending each American out to the polls. And then I did not firsthand see the presentation on the Christian right being hijacked and so on. But I think all of that sort of lends itself to this evolution. We seem to be more polarized now in partisan politics than we ever have before. Yet I'm left with this feeling that most of America is not far to the left or far to the right, but most of America is somewhere kind of in the middle, taking an issue-by-issue look.
Okay.
And yet, ironically, if you're back on the Hill, those who were inside, and I'm not one of them, but, you know, for example, Ted Kennedy's best friend is Orrin Hatch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, you agree on anything, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, so much so that Orrin Hatch could not, in good conscience, campaign for William Weld when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate seat. So there is this conciliation underneath,
right.
But what America is confronted is different.
It's very true. I would, in terms of political spectrum, I don't like this left to right thing. First of all, I think some is in here and out there and up there and down here and over there and back there. I mean, the political spectrum, Jesse Ventura, our former wrestler governor, was quite treat to deal with. He wasn't the worst governor. He would have actually been pretty good if he wasn't so into himself.
Bill made him mad.
He was, yeah. He had the thinnest skin. He talked about how he was a tough guy. He had the thinnest skin of anybody I know. He did not take well to criticism. He ridiculed the media and everybody for anything. And but he was, he described himself as a centrist. He came from the Independence Party, called himself a centrist. And so I know a bunch of rural Democrats who said, hey, they had a news conference right after he'd been elected saying, hey, we're going to work really well with the governor. We're a centrist too. And I was going to say, well, what they define as centrist in Minnesota, it was kind of, tends to be things like, the simplest way I would define if somebody's a centrist by Minnesota definitions, a pro-life Democrat or a pro-choice Republican. In other words, you're with your party except on one or two social issues and so on. And what I was going to say is those centrist Democrats tended to be very conservative on the social issues and much more on economic issues, much more spending prone than the governor was. He was very fiscally conservative, though he actually was one of the few who actually called for a tax increase when he thought we needed it. So I would argue he's actually pretty responsible about it. He was much more conservative on fiscal matters and very, very progressive on social issues. So they actually kind of agreed with him on nothing. But on average, by their definition of centrist, they were all in there together. And so I have trouble with that definition of spectrum. And also I'd argue that when you look at the, like take the presidential race, the last two or four or six of them, if you take certain issues like healthcare, I can show you any poll in the past 20 years to ask if people think we should have universal health care. What exactly that means, but basically that everybody has health care. How it's delivered, you can get into the arguments about it and so on. But you will have well over 60%, usually closer to 70%, supporting universal health care. And that's a landslide in politics. And yet neither presidential candidate of either party for the last three, four times has been willing to even put that on the agenda. Same thing in our state government. So I would argue it's not that sometimes what the political spectrum is sometimes at the Capitol tends to be in here, whether that's the center or not, and people are over way far away from that, and we're not even talking about their issues. Paul Wellstone wasn't seen as a centrist in Minnesota politics. One of the last speeches I heard him give, he talked about we've got to get back to the center in American politics. And he said not the center the way people define it is average of everything, but the center of what's important to people's lives, their education system, their health care, their environment, and so on, the center of what's important in people's lives, which I thought was a nice way to do it, but it shows how we all use terms differently. But yeah, there is a whole part of that. I do feel some of my best friends are people. One guy sitting next to me in the Judiciary Committee, we get along very well. I'm sitting two seats down in tax committee, we disagree on just about everything. But I'd say we're very good friends. I mean, we don't socialize outside of the Capitol, but we can always joke with each other and everything else. And that's what I like, because actually most of the people in our legislative body get along pretty well, but it's getting to the point where a few of them are just growing number, are just going to be just brutal to people they disagree with personally as well as politically. And that tears things apart. If you, I do think socializing outside of it is not a bad thing to do because you got to see them as humans who have complex things.
I'm Anna McDonald from Rochester, Minnesota, and I was actually wondering if you could speak to the universal health care, maybe not Minnesota specifically, but universal health care, stumbling blocks that there are in place and why we haven't been able to move towards it at all.
Okay.
And maybe not Minnesota specifically.
Right. I actually am doing a talk on the politics of healthcare on Friday, tomorrow. But yes, I think there. It's amazing we haven't addressed it yet. And it's, I had a guy who was head of Minnesota's for national healthcare, for physicians for national healthcare, or something like that, about 10 years ago, to me, Johnny, I think we're going to get universal healthcare quicker than I used to think. So why do you say that? The system's crumbling faster than I thought it would. And it is. I mean, our daughter graduates from college next year. She may go overseas for a couple of years, may go to grad school. But if she's not doing that, she's going out into the working world, she has no health care. I mean, she's dropped from our policy. We don't have a choice. And the average we're spending in this country on healthcare is over $5,500 a person. Family of four like ours, it's $22,000. That's not what we pay. That's what government pays, that's what our employers pay, that's what we pay all together. It would be over $22,000 for a family of four. I mean, that's just incredibly high. It's 60% more than Switzerland, which is the second highest. And because we're getting to the point where everybody's failing, it's the number one cause of bankruptcy in our country. And of those who become bankrupt because of health care, that's not the uninsured. 3/4 of them had insurance. They're us, who then get a serious illness, takes you away from work, you lose your insurance, and you go bankrupt by one illness. So there's a lot of public interest in the issue. For some reason, it hasn't gelled as a political issue enough in the election. I think sometime it could just turn over overnight that way. But nevertheless, there are incredible obstacles. People who are doing well under the current system like it. William McGuire, who is the head of United Healthcare, for-profit company based in Minnesota, though Minnesota doesn't allow for-profit health plans, he took home last year, I think it was $194, somewhere in there, $1 million, which somebody calculated out as saying that would be enough to provide health care for all 77,000 Minnesota kids who don't have health care. One person's salary. I mean, that's just the CEO, and he's got several others who work with him who are very well paid, though not quite on the same scale. He's not trying to get anything changed in the system. The lobbying in the medical community, there's so many interests in it. I mean, certainly there's the doctors and the nurses in the hospital, but there are also the medical tech firms, there are the insurance plans, there are everybody else, and they all have their vested interest in it, so we tinker with it. And I would argue it's partly because there's a lack of vision. When Clinton was the last president to propose some sort of universal health care, and he couldn't explain it. They get so trying to compromise on how we do it and don't want to offend people. In the end, they had, I think the book explaining it was this law. And when he tried to do it, the only thing that connected with people, I think, was when he expressed it during the State of the Union address. And if I recall, he took out his wallet and said, "You've got a Social Security card. We want you to have a health security card. If you're sick, you're going to get to the doctor. We'll take care of how we pay for that, but it's going to be taken care of. So you can go to the doctor when you need." People understand that concept. In terms of trying to, well, we don't want to rock the boat too much here, we don't want to do that there, because there are pretty powerful interests there. And there's no interest that's, in terms of funding campaigns, which is a big problem with our political system. There's all those other interests are very generous in the political process. And those who want universal health care, the public at large, don't give money because this is the candidate who's pushing for universal health care. And just to show one example, I talked in the talk earlier this week or last week about the role of money in politics. And at the end, I mentioned a letter that I received shortly after I was elected. The letter was stunning to me, and I saved the letter, and I quote it often, and I know it almost word for word 20 years later. Congratulations on your election. Hard work really pays off. This is a guy I've known before I run. He's a big-time lobbyist. One of my clients had the misfortune of contributing to your opponent. Here is a contribution as they wish to make amends. And my comment was, what was the misfortune? Did they make a mistake and give it to the wrong guy because they found out I was actually better for their interest? No, they gave to him because he was supposed to win. He was everybody, all the papers, everybody thought he was going to win. Mine was the biggest upset, according to the two big papers that year. So they gave money to the guy who was going to win. Not because he'd be best for the state, even best for their industry, but because he was going to win. They had to make amends because they had given to him. What was their interest? I don't even remember which side it was, but it was either optometrists or ophthalmologists. And ophthalmologists are the eye doctors who are gone through 4 years of medical school and everything, and the optometrists are the ones who have gone through at least 4 years of training, but they're not fully medical doctors, and they want to have authority to prescribe certain eye drugs that the ophthalmologists say, well, look, if it interacts wrong, and these guys haven't had the 4 years of training, and so on. Very hot thing, because it makes a lot of difference economically to both sides. And I don't know which side this guy was on, but he was representing one side or another. They make sure they make the contributions when the thing comes in. Hey, John, good buddy, you know, we'd like your help on this. That's what I would argue is the biggest single burden, the fact that our campaign finance system is tilted that way, and there are, it's not two sides of that issue. There are 10,000 sides because there are 10,000 interests. I'll try and be shorter with answers, but anyway, you can follow up on what's been said or turn it to a new direction.
I don't know whether it's just the general climate around the country or whether it's another lot of issues. But in Washington State, up until a year ago, we didn't used to have to declare any kind of party affiliation.
You do now?
We do now. And
for primary voting.
For primaries. But it used to be that you could walk in, and, you know, I know that there were probably some people who would vote for the other guy's candidate, the other guy's weaker candidate.
Pick the weaker candidate,
so that you could win. I know specifically one election when that probably didn't make a difference. But generally speaking, people didn't call themselves, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, mm-hmm. or whatever, I'm a voter. Mm-hmm. And, we used to really particularly go to caucuses unless they were very involved, and, now if you really want to get the right candidate, you better go to your caucus, and I suppose you get more involvement. But it really does seem to kind of polarize people.
Yeah. Minnesota does not have that. We had one presidential primary because people were trying to get rid of our caucus system. I actually think the caucus system is a good system because it gets people together in groups like this with their neighbors and like the Iowa, it's like the old New England town meeting. You come and you debate politics and you pick your choices of candidates, but there's a lot of weaknesses in it too. So and in recent years, our candidates who get the party nomination usually often, at least the state level, don't win the primary. I won our party's nomination and the primary through the caucus system and the primary, but a lot of them have since that time one of the two times since then that candidate hasn't won. But the primaries, again, the reason the caucuses were reformed on that was because party bosses had a lot of power and so on. The reason in some states you have to declare is because the courts have basically said that the parties are, it's their free speech right to organize. I mean, who you meet with, who you're affiliated with, is a free speech right. And if you want to say you've got to meet these standards to be in our party, you can do that. I mean, because there's supposed to be no kind of, the Constitution doesn't even mention political parties. And so the issue is, we want to keep those people who are just trying to muck things up. I've suggested in ours, because those who say, well, we ought to have that, I said, I don't have any problem with limiting primaries to people who consider themselves part of the party, but you don't have to make that public. One of the reasons people want it public is candidates want it, because, hey, it's pretty hard to know who's on your side, and so on. We both parties in Minnesota do a lot of phoning, which is getting less and less effective because nobody answers the phone anymore, caller ID. It's not covered by do not call. I think the courts would not allow do not call laws to do that, and it doesn't mention them anyway. But they try and identify parties, so the candidates really love that. And I've argued that, we're not doing this for the benefit of the candidates, though. And so what I've suggested is, all we do when you sign into our party caucus, then you're in effect saying, I consider myself to be in Minnesota, Democratic, farmer, laborer, right? DFL, or Democrat, whatever. I consider myself to be that and expect to be voting primarily for people of that party. There's no commitment, but you're saying, I honestly am not a Republican playing games. And it seems to me that if you give somebody a ballot in the primary and it has a Democratic one, a Republican one, an Independence Party one, Green Party, whatever you have, and you have given the ballot, and when they sign, register in at the polling place where you have to sign at ours, you just are signing as part of the oath. I will vote in the party I consider myself to be a member of or expect to be voting primarily for its candidates. And then, if I think, I might really consider myself more a Green Party person, but really I'm going to vote more for Democrats. That's fine, I can sign that. And nobody's going to know which ballot I take out because you fill out only that column, which is all you can do now. And nobody's going to know which party I voted in. But I would at least be saying an oath, and would people cheat? A lot of people, when you're signing something, saying I consider this, they they take it seriously. And I think that's what we should do. Again, each state sets its own rules, and each party has the ability to.
Do you mean each time you vote, you sign at that point?
Yeah. In fact, I'm saying that the party I voted for today, this is one I expect in November, I'll probably be voting for more of their candidates. And I put it pretty loosely because, frankly, I think most parties would rather have it be loosely done. You really do want people to vote in your primary. You just don't want troublemakers who are, I've heard people, Democrats, the year I was running for governor, voted in the Republican primary because there was this one guy, the incumbent was a lot more moderate, I guess is the term they used, and the other guy running, and they were scared, and so they crossed over for him, and they never came back in November and voted for me. But I do think that there's merit to saying people should be a member of a party, not in the sense that I sign my mind, because most people are, as you said, independents. But, you know, if you're independent, you lean Republican, you're mainly going to vote Republican, you should be allowed to vote in their primary. I think they probably want you to, but maybe you shouldn't. In effect, I think that kind of pledge would be only saying you're not going to try and muck up something. You're voting for what you believe in.
But, you know, and for me personally, I felt like I was being asked to make a choice that I never had to make before, because I always voted how I felt, and it didn't matter what party, and then that.
Most people are that way. Yeah. In Minnesota, the place we have the most problem, because we don't have that requirement, is election judges. Our law basically says each party shall give to the local county auditor, shall give so and so many names of party members who they could contact for serving as election judges. Parties never provide enough names. So they start ending up calling in a whole lot of people, legal women, voter types, senior citizens, so on, who consider themselves politically independent. They don't want to put down there for one party or the other. And when somebody starts telling them they got to, so usually with a lot of them, we now have an independence party. So they'll say, well, I'm an independent. And then the auditor will say, okay, we'll put you down for the independent party, which they're not. But they do that because they want to have some balance. You understand why you want to have judges, so you don't have all Democratic judges in a precinct or all Republican ones, because they might fudge things. And so I think it's reasonable that you turn first to the parties, but I've carried a bill for several years to say that you know, once they exhaust the party lists, because it is a party primary, and so, once you exhaust the party list, you should be able to turn to anybody who wants to. That way, if a party is concerned that this precinct is going to be all Republican judges there, then well, we'll make go for an effort and get some people to be judges there. But it really offends people because, I would guess, I mean, older generation tend to be more partisan set. Younger folks, well, now middle-aged folks, I guess, we consider themselves more independent, and some of the younger ones are getting more partisan again. But I think the party affiliation is pretty weak in this country, unlike a lot of countries.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the younger folks. I'm Jody Cressman from Chicago, where of course we vote early and often. Continue to vote.
I'll tell you a story.
After our demise, we continue to vote. I'm really concerned about young people and their relationship to electoral politics. The irony is, as you well know, that more and more young people are actively volunteering in community service, doing all kinds of stuff at the community level. But fewer and fewer of them are active electorally in electoral politics. And that gap is really one of the concerns me a lot. Do you have any ideas about how to sort of reconnect young people to the importance of the political system and public life in that way?
One, based on what you were saying, but first let me tell you my little story about Cook County. I was first allowed to vote in 19, went off to college in fall of 74, and I turned 18 a couple of days before the election, so I was able to vote, and I voted absentee from my home Chicago area, and registered to vote, and about a year later I decided I considered Minnesota more of my home already, and so I wrote the county or the election official, whatever, and said, you know, please remove my name from the voting list. I'm transferring my voting to Minnesota, which I bet you not one in a thousand people do it, but I was a college kid and wanted to do it right, and so I did that. Anyway, about 1989, I was already in the state senate then. This is a decade plus later. that's in the state senate, and I got this, and Dad forwarded it 2 years in a row. I got it. It was my voter registration right. from Cook County, Illinois, 1989 and 1990. I have the cards. I saved them. Because that was like 15 years after I had sent them a note saying, I thought, what, how many times I voted in that period?
That's right. It's very hard to get
it's,
off.
It's amazing. Voter rolls in Chicago. It's amazing.
Not even Jeff.
And I hope I haven't been voting there.
Yeah.
But it would be interesting. I should have checked that. But in terms of what I thought was interesting that you identified it as young people, and maybe it's the ones you see, and I'm not going to disagree with it because I think it might be true, young people getting more involved in community, volunteering, and so on. I would argue that that is a good way to get people involved in electoral politics. When you are working, if you're volunteering to make life better for senior, even little kids often, go volunteer at a nursing home and shout, little children's choir will go sing there and so on. When people volunteer, not the little kids, but when high school kids are volunteering in something, they see, look, these nursing homes are just going to pieces because there's no funding for them or whatever. Sometimes that's the time I think you connect people politically. You're doing all this work trying to do that, but the system's working against you. It's making it worse. And I think a lot of, I mean, people younger than youth who are people who have kids in the schools tend to be, they get involved sometimes in politics because they're frustrated with what's going on in the schools for a variety of reasons, either funding or they don't like what's being taught or how it's being taught or whatever. But they tend to get involved in politics because of that. And I think that may be a way of getting young kids involved. But part of the trouble is I think cynicism about politics is a very harmful thing. Criticism is a very good thing, and unfortunately, the more you know about our political system, the more critical I think you ought to be about it, because it's really in terrible shape. But cynical is different between cynicism and criticism. In my mind, is both of them say something wrong. One of them says, this is really bad, we got to do something about it. The other one is, they're all a bunch of crooks. And it's a disengaging, we're not going to be involved because it's worthless. And I think a lot of young people, partly because they listen to television, and they don't listen to news, they don't listen to much else, but they hear TV and radio ads, and one politician says, my opponent's a scum of the earth. In other words, my opponent's a slime. And they begin to believe it. And, you know, and they're both slimes, so why should we vote for either one of them? And so why bother to vote? And I think it's very important to tell them, you know, that's why you should vote, to make sure you have a process that's good. And but I think that one of the few ways I know, I think our schools have to do a better job of somebody, when we were talking about media, several people suggested about making sure we're more media literate, how you use the media in a way that you have the best chance of getting fair and good information. But in the same way, we have to teach people the importance of citizenship. I mean, in my mind, it's one of the reasons we shouldn't view education as job training. It's one aspect of education. And year after I lost my race for governor, the incumbent gave a statement that I was just stunned at. I was shocked that the higher education systems in the state didn't scream. But he said, you know, he was a little bit concerned that Minnesota was sending too many people to 4 years of higher education when a lot of the job market didn't require that. And I thought, you know, I thought education was important to make us good citizens and good neighbors and good people. And that all of the things, if you have a democracy, you got to have people have more than skills in how to run a welding machine. You got to have people know something about everything. And so I was stunned that nobody in their private college or the state university system or the University of Minnesota, nobody said a word about it, partly because they know, you know, you don't want to offend the governor when you're talking about funding. But I think the schools have to do a better job, we as parents have to do a better job, and that is encourage the criticism and discourage the cynicism at the same time. And the kids who are most involved are the ones most easy to reach into that.
I think Sandra Day O'Connor, since she left the bench, has aligned herself with some other people of note, and I can't say who they are because I don't know. I don't remember. But they are working on that very issue, to provide the schools with help and direction on how to provide better civics training or education for young people. So it's recognized at higher levels as a real serious problem.
And she's also doing a good job now. She's been attacks on the courts, trying to make the courts more partisan and everything else like that. She is explaining what I think a lot of people involved in the judicial system are very afraid of, that the courts are becoming heavily political. And that's a very big danger to our country. There are lots of things that are a big danger to our country. That's a big one. And so I'm glad, and I can't think of a lot of former Supreme Court justices, most of them because they are very ill and old before they retire. I can't think of any, not many in recent years who have done what she's done and start getting involved and speaking.
No.
And she could do a tremendous amount of good on that.
In the state of Washington, there's currently a state Supreme Court race. Two incumbents are being challenged by two challengers who are being heavily financed by the building industries.
Okay.
And the building industry has more money than the Almighty. And so much so that the legislature actually passed a law which cut off, you know, the ability to, you know, the funding, put the funding limits. But of course, you know, this very recently became applicable or effective. And so of course they were able to, you know, front load their spending in advance of that. Mm-hmm. I've worked in the judicial branch.
Okay.
It's very, very, very troubling,
yeah.
Regardless of what level you're at, because you know you take an oath to support the law regardless of what you personally believe it is or ought to be.
Right. And now with the political party endorsements,
and it's scary stuff, actually.
Yeah. Oh, it's very scary. Minnesota is a few steps behind you on that. Minnesota, we had a system, our judges were all, they're elected, but the way it's worked, as long as I can remember, I know for at least 40 years, judges resign before their term is up. The governor appoints their successor, and then basically the next election, they're an incumbent, and it says incumbent on the ballot, which if you put incumbent after politicians' names, it's a sure sign of defeat. But for judges, because people understand you want to have the ability of judiciary, it's been the case. And in our case, we had all kinds of code of judicial conduct that prohibited any discussion of any issues that might come before the courts and so on. And endorsements that judges are not supposed to see, lists of who contributes to their campaigns. Basically, we had not real elections. They're kind of phony elections, and there's a guy who, although I strongly disagree with him, he's probably constitutionally right, at least the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's agreed with him, and that is that our laws are unconstitutional. And the courts have basically said, if you've got an electoral process, it's got to be an election. How do you decide on somebody besides that? So I've met with a task force that our Supreme Court's pulled together, and State Bar Association and others have, of what we're doing about it. I happen to favor, some people are saying, well, we ought to have retention elections then. We're going to, they'll be all appointed, but they all, after 3-4 years, they all have a retention election. So their name's on the ballot, you can vote yes, retain them, or no, do it. I think it's a terrible idea. It gives groups like the Builders group here, or an abortion group, or any kind of group of any sort, environmental group, whoever, it gives them a hit list. Just saying no to Judge so-and-so is a lot easier than, is it Smith or Thompson you wanted to vote for? And so I've opposed that. What I've been suggesting is, one of my colleagues who also spoke to this panel, she was arguing, we got to be very cautious. Our system's worked in Minnesota for many years. And I'm saying, we got to be very cautious. Our system's worked in Minnesota for very many years, but that system's not here anymore. And the closest we can come to what I favor is a gubernatorial appointment process. And the last, in Minnesota, since 1970, we had a Democratic governor, Republican governor, Democrat, Republican, Independence Party, and another Republican. And I'd say among all of them, I would say their judicial appointments have been one of the best things they've done. We've got a very good judiciary in Minnesota, and I'm very scared what's happening with the judicial elections. So I'm sorry to hear you. What worries me, I've got a very conservative Republican opponent who is backed by all the groups on abortion and so on that want to have this, that want to make endorsements, that want to go after this, and he's carrying the bill that I've been supporting to replace a constitutional amendment to replace our system with an appointment process with confirmation and so on. And I keep worrying that he's very good at it, and he's perfect for it, and there are some of us on each side of the issue on it. But what worries me is because everybody said, well, the courts, the judges didn't want to look like they were self-serving and didn't want to stand for election. So they were staying out of it. And my fear is that once we have a very partisan election, and once we do that, then the groups who he gets a lot of his other support from the rest of the time will make the pressure so great that he can't carry the bill, and it'll be then the same groups that want to destroy the judicial election thing are going to be the ones who block the reform from happening. So I was wishing we could do it this year, because we have one, maybe two Supreme Court justices up on the ballot this year, and as of when I left, there was still no challenger. We'll know by July. Yes?
I've been quiet, and I've been taking notes. My name's Daniel Tolleru.
Tolleru?
Tolleru, and I'm not from Lake Wobegon, by the way. And not from Minnesota. My dad was, but he moved to Chicago more than any other during my kind of Quad Cities. And my Quad Cities. Attend church in Moline, and we all kind of together there. And I was asked to give a message to a mission of people who are homeless in the area. And being in the Stephen Ministry and being very active in the church, I decided to do that. Well, here, I'm pro-Democrat. I take a stand. I'm union member of the 25. There is a plumber and pipe fitter, and also an ex-history teacher. And so I have quite a background. But see, here I am trying to talk to people who are homeless and have no money, and they've lost hope, and my husband and I are now calling them. How do I relate to them? I found a way to do that, though, was just to tell my story. And I talked for half an hour. I can do that here, but I'm taking more time. But I get very discouraged. As a teacher, I can see that in history, we had a checks and balance system. We had to know that in our federal government. And our balance, I think, is that the grassroots coming in and working and working out. But I see it failing in the balance of money in high-end business, taking our jobs overseas. And where these people that I've been talking about, that are homeless, they've lost hope. They can't get jobs. Their jobs have been replaced by the computer and by robotics, and they end up on the street. They don't want to retrain. So then, you talked before about people who help themselves. Well, if they lost hope, where do they get the help? So what I did when I would talk to them, I'd talk about what happened. Well, it used to be like what happened and where I'm at now. And maybe they could identify with that a little bit, and it could uplift them enough to give me hope. But there were times when I was really down the bottom. So I think that it's really personal and come out and tell my story. It's part of the 12-step spirituality program. And it does help, I think. It's helped me a great deal, and it's helped others. And the main reason why I'm in music, as you may know, I play piano, I play clarinet. I get back into my feelings, and I get centered, and I don't have to worry so much about what's going on. Because the more spiritual I get, the more I fear our political system. And it's just great to be up here.
Yeah, when you meet with homeless folks, I presume very, very few of them vote.
Right.
And they feel it's a hopeless case, which is troubling. People without the health insurance, without the health, without the housing, without the whatever, are the ones who most need the system to be give them a fair shake, and they're the ones who are least involved. I mean, there is no lobby for homeless people.
Right.
Fortunately, in Minnesota, at least in the last few years, one of the best organized things, rather than getting more postcards on it than just about anything else, was on homelessness, because a number of church groups are saying,
yeah,
look, it's really nice to see somebody come in and organizing lobbying for somebody else. Instead of, I want more tax breaks for me, I want more for this business or this interest or that. I want to do this for somebody else. And it's been very well organized, but the impact has not been great, because I think a lot of elected officials figure, well, they're not voting on that anyway. They do care enough to send a letter, but I think it is beginning to have an impact. But the sad thing is, I mean, it's kind of like in the 50s and 60s in the South, the people who were most anti-integration, most anti-black, were the poor whites who had the most in common with them. Very much oppressed, very much unfairly treated. But what do? Those who have blame somebody else, and so you pick on them because they're taking away our whatever. I think it's very important we find a way to engage people, and but the process is getting worse in terms of respecting the needs of. I mean, I keep pointing out in homelessness, Minnesota didn't have. We had some homeless shelters as long as I can remember, but in the 70s, Union Gospel Mission, they were these church-based, usually, programs that were, they dealt with chemically dependent and mentally ill people who were street people. And we still have them. We haven't ever done a good job with them, but now we got families, we got kids, we got working people. Half the people in Minnesota homeless shelters on any given night, we have a foundation that does a study every other year, so and they do a sample night, they survey everywhere in the state they can. And half the people who are homeless on any given night are either working people or families of working people who just can't make it. And, you know, if I did a thing on living wage, I think it was last week, and how we set up a system that relies less on government and more on people earning a fair wage. And I really believe that the polls will consistently show that overwhelmingly Americans believe that if you work full-time, you should be able to have enough to support your family. And that doesn't just mean you have enough for food, you got enough for housing and health care and so on, to meet basic necessities, kind of what I'd argue the social compact of the 1930s was. You work 40 hours, that became the full-time thing. There were pushes to make it 48 and so on, but it was dropped all the way to 40. And that was full-time work. You do that, and we would pay you a minimum wage, which wouldn't make you rich, but it would meet your needs. And if minimum wage had kept a CEO salary, CEO compensation since 1990, would be well over $12 an hour now. It's not. So I would argue those are the people who most got engaged, but it's frustrating because they're the most. Why bother? And when they see it, I keep arguing to my colleagues that, I've been in office for 20 years, we've raised the minimum wage 3 or 4 times. Each time it's by 75 cents or 50 cents or a dollar. And each time we wait 3-4 years and inflation takes away another dollar and a half, then we raise it 50 cents more. We're winning the battles and losing the war. And to me, I mean, when these are on the ballots, I mean, everybody talked about what happened with gay marriage on all the ballots. Well, I think it was Florida and one other southern state, Arkansas or someplace, both had voter initiatives on the ballot for a significant increase in minimum wage. Both passed solid votes. And that's not a conservative position. But, I mean, in my mind, a lot of people making $8 an hour who can't make ends meet, they think a bunch of politicians, well, the Republicans are opposed to minimum wage increase, the Democrats are for $1 an hour, $6.15 an hour, and heck, I'm making more than that. How do they think so? They don't buy either side doing anything to help them. Frankly, an increase in the minimum wage would tend to push up their stipend. But they don't see it as helping them. So they see the process as irrelevant to them.
And America doesn't seem to really grasp the concept of the working poor. I think that's actually a relatively contemporary concept that people can be homeless and be poor.
Because they weren't 30, 40 years ago. The trouble was some people, because of either history or mental illness or whatever, weren't working and couldn't afford to. But if you were working, you tended to not be homeless. And it's very scary. And the public doesn't support. I mean, they think we should do something about it, but we're not close. So I had a proposal that would basically set up a system to provide a living wage, which I define as fairly high, probably not as high as most people think it should be in order to be a living wage, but that employers who pay less than that wouldn't be forced to, but they'd have to pay a third and eventually two-thirds the differential to a fund that goes to what's our earned income tax credit for low-income working people. So it doesn't go to fund any state program, it just goes to increase the compensation of all low-income workers around the state. So they can either, like if I had $14 an hour if they didn't provide benefits in our metro area, if Walmart pays $8 an hour with no benefits, and it's $14 an hour of that $6 differential. They'd eventually, they'd start by paying $2, eventually $4 an hour into that. At that time, Walmart can decide, we're going to pay $12 an hour to our employees, and they get $8 of it, or we're going to pay $14, and they get all $14. I think they would choose to pay the living wage, because there are costs to hiring new employees and training new employees that are very significant. Anyway, that's a bit off the track of this, but it is a...
Well, that's kind of what I don't know just how to get to this, but why? What happened to the 40-hour week? I mean, you hear people that are making $60,000-$70,000 a year, but they're saying, I haven't got time for anything. I'm working 70 hours a week. Well, why are these people working 70 hours a week when we could have
two people working
$35 a week, and we wouldn't have this huge wage scale up here for these people are making a lot of money, but when do they have time to enjoy their money?
Right.
Or the 40-hour week guy down here makes so little, but he doesn't make enough money to do anything except stay home and eat and have
I think we'd be a lot healthier society if we did more like Europeans did, more vacations and more like 40 hours than 60 hours. I mean, there are plenty of people who work more than 40 hours a week because they love what they're doing and want to. But there are a whole lot more who are doing it because they're forced to. Nurses in Minnesota, which is a very high-skilled position, many of them are forced into overtime, and much overtime. And actually, a lot of employers are playing two games. One, they're working people 60 hours a week or more, so they only have one person to pay benefits to, and they can work them more. And then on the other hand, they have other people, I think a lot of retailers, Target and Walmart, and so hire a lot of people for 25 hours a week, so they don't have to pay them any benefits.
And they can't live.
And it's, I mean, when I see how they treat high school kids, this kid we have with us on this trip, his older brother's high school kids, and they and their friends get summer jobs at McDonald's or something. How many hours they work? 10. When are they on call? Always. You come in today and we need you in 2 hours to work here. And they won't guarantee them anyway, any time. And they're always got to be there if they want the job. But they play games. And the wage and hour standards we set up in the 1930s were...
So is
that's
that,
basically what we got. And we're not enforcing it much.
Did that happen because there aren't so many unions anymore?
That would be part of it. Unions tend to be able to push. I mean, it was unions who got us the 40-hour week. It was they who got weekends off. It was those who got us minimum wage. I mean, largely their political clout, but that's been declining. Actually, if you have good wage and hour laws, you don't need unions as much. But we don't have good wage and hour laws. And worker safety laws, the whole range of things for workers. And I think it's a shame to see how people, I read a story with, the other morning, I think it was, I had one of those morning sessions, and talked about how Americans, after Katrina, why so many people didn't leave before Katrina hit, and read a story of a guy who said, he and his wife, the most they ever had was $400 or $500, and $400 of that would go to the rent, and he made $20,000 as a graphic designer, but that's when things were going well, and they didn't have any money in the bank. They took public transportation, didn't have a car. He said there was no way in the world they could scrape up $2,000 to get airfare, rental car, and a place to stay. He said they just told it up and said they didn't have any choice. And they said the reporter was telling his story, and he said, basically what I do, even in the good times, me and my wife, we'd go out about once a month to Piccadilly's, which I think is a pizza place. No movies or anything. He said, basically, I work all day, come home, have dinner, talk with my wife, then we go to bed, go to work the next day. It was just a basic existence, he said. He was complaining he couldn't call his son to let him know they were okay because he only had 50 cents. Didn't have the dollar needed for the long-distance call. That's a shame. This guy's working hard and he has no pleasure in life. Granted, that's what much of history has been, but...
that's right.
Yeah, but it doesn't need to be that way. We've got so much...
Well, no, things that I used to work in a union job and made a living wage. Now, there's people that are doing the same thing that I did, working for only $4 or $5 an hour with absolutely no benefits, and we have benefits.
Yeah. It's the fall of unions has been one of the reasons we've got this problem. Again, as I said, we had great labor laws. We wouldn't need unions, but unions are the ones who brought us the great labor laws and kept pushing that way, and they've been falling off. And I talked with one labor leader in northern Minnesota when I was running for governor. He told me, you know, he was so sad about it because his son said, yeah, Dad, I know it means a lot to you. It's your job and so on. But, he didn't have any sense of it. He didn't understand any history of what the labor movement was about.
I'd have to argue that the labor unions provided checks and balance for
they
the
do.
Industry, otherwise the industry would take off.
Yeah.
And it had
and that's what they've been doing.
Yeah. And the unions that would work to fight to get their score deal. But when the manufacturing goes to Mexico and Taiwan and Chicago, then the unions are powerless. They just don't.
Which is one of the reasons I think the unions were fighting NAFTA and some of the global trade agreements. Most of them, at least most of the ones I've worked with, favor fair trade. In other words, they're not anti-trade, but the way we're setting things up. All of our recent presidents have all been in favor of more trade, and they call it the free trade approach. Oh, it increases the economy. Both sides benefit. I just saw a recent study that if we expanded the fair trade agreements to free trade agreements to everyone in the world, all countries, it would over the next 10 years would increase the global net economy by $140 billion or something. It wasn't as much as I thought, but it said the net economy of the poorer countries would go down by $20 billion. So in other words, theirs would go down and ours would go up by $160, which is why a lot of our economists, not all of them, favor it because it'll help. But a lot of our farmers and working people see, the reason it's increasing the economy is it's increasing agribusiness is growing, agriculture workers are making less here and in Mexico. But I think the labor movement was a big push for a whole lot of what we have. Any last question? I'm happy to talk more informally, but just wanted to have a session in which we could talk whatever people wanted to raise. Sure. And I will be doing one tomorrow on healthcare yet. So. If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.